In addition to MCAST, a subscription to emedhome.com includes over 1,000 video lectures from the best EM conferences, with more added all the time. View on any device whenever and wherever you want. All this and so much more, including hundreds of CME credits each year for the low cost of only $99. emedhome.com. For 20 years, the homepage of emergency medicine. Subscribe now.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the September 2023 issue of EMED Home's EMCast. This is Amal Mattu from University of Maryland School of Medicine, and once again, welcome back. Well, this month we've got a great series of discussions. We've actually got four on tap for you this month. We're going to start things off by talking about a neurologic condition that I don't know that we've discussed before, and it was something that I never ever heard of before when I was back in residency, but now it seems to be something that's discussed and even diagnosed quite often. Probably always been out there. We just didn't know what to call it and didn't know what to do about it. And that is posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome. And discussing this is going to be our critical care expert, Dr. Mike Winters. This is based on a publication from earlier this year in the New England Journal of Medicine. So it's one of those articles that I think stands a really good chance of showing up on the list of required readings for the LLSA. Next, we're going to spend some time talking about a white paper that was published by the American Academy of Emergency Medicine in the Journal of Emergency Medicine on alcohol use disorder. Dr. Rob Flint is going to be discussing a whole host of questions that were brought up in that article. Some of them are things that probably you already are doing, but there are a few new medications and new surprises, at least based on what I thought I knew about managing these patients. And so stay tuned for that. The third topic we're going to discuss is something that's very timely given everything that's going on in the world at this moment, and that is heat illness. Dr. Cheyenne Fallot, our wilderness and environmental expert, is going to spend some time talking about the latest and greatest bits of knowledge, pearls, and pitfalls with regards to managing heat illness. And this is, as I mentioned, very timely given how most of the northern hemisphere, at least of the world, is sweltering under oppressive heat conditions. And then we're going to wrap things up by talking about managing the hospice patient in the emergency department. Dr. Danya Koja, who is our geriatric expert, is going to spend some time talking about what to think about and what to do with regards to optimizing care of these patients when they do show up in the emergency department. So with that, let's go ahead and jump right in. All right, well, welcome back. We're going to kick EMCast off this month with a discussion of a neurologic condition called posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, which is definitely a mouthful. It's something that showed up in New England Journal, on June 8th, 2023, a nice review article. And it's definitely something that I've been hearing about somewhat more frequently over the past few years. And to help us go through this topic is one of my colleagues, Dr. Mike Winters. Mike, as you recall, is a critical care aficionado. He's emergency medicine, internal medicine trained, and has for many, many years overseen our EMIM critical care program and actually created that program. And he still does a lot of lecturing and teaching on the interface between emergency medicine and critical care. And this topic certainly does cross over between critical care and EM and neurology. And so, Mike, thanks for coming back to EMCast and helping us get through this topic.
Thanks so much, Amal, for having me back on EMCast. Really, really always enjoy our conversations and excited to get into a deeper dive on PRESS.
Definitely. Well, as I kind of started talking about, when I was in residency and years past, I never heard of anything called posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, or say, we'll just use the abbreviation PRESS. But now it seems I hear about it all the time, especially from the neurologists when they're coming down to consult on patients. So why don't we just start out by maybe having you tell us what exactly is PRESS?
Sure thing. And Amal, I would concur with you. It's not something that we did a super deep dive on at any point during my training. I've certainly been hearing about it in the recent years. And well, as Dr. Geocaden talks about in the first few paragraphs of his review article, well, maybe that name even no longer applies, and that it fails to capture all the features of this disorder that we're going to talk about. So you may intermittently hear folks refer to this as reversible posterior leukencephalopathy. But having said that, PRESS, as we're talking about it, is an acute or subacute cerebral syndrome whose main clinical manifestations, what we see, are headache, encephalopathy, seizures, and visual disturbances. And in general, this is typically occurring in patients that are presenting with an acute and severe elevation in hypertension or any type of elevation in blood pressure for that particular patient that goes outside of their normal range.
Okay, great. Well, we both agree that this is something that seems to be being discussed and diagnosed more often just in recent years. But how common is this diagnosis and this condition? Is this just some zebra diagnosis, or is this really something that we all need to know about and maybe we've been missing for many years?
It's a great question, and I think in general, nobody really knows how common it is. In fact, the incidence, if we talk about just the general population, is very difficult to determine. Dr. Geocaden goes through a few specific patient populations where we have a little bit more literature, such as our patients with end-stage renal disease, a little under 1%, or he quotes 0.8% of patients with end-stage renal disease are at risk or develop PRESS at some point during their lifetime. As we'll talk about in the etiologies of PRESS, autoimmune conditions can cause PRESS. And for our patients with lupus, about 0.7% of the time, our transplant patients, and that may be due to medications that they're on, are at risk for PRESS. And around a half a percent of transplant patients end up developing PRESS. And a statistic that I was a bit surprised about really pertains to our patients with preeclampsia or eclampsia, in that the article quotes anywhere from about 1 out of 5, so 20%, all the way up to almost 100% of patients with preeclampsia or eclampsia will have evidence of PRESS on neuroimaging. Now, moving to a different patient population, fairly rare in our pediatric population, about 0.5%. But I think, Amal, the take-home message is really, this can occur in any and all age range or age groups. We do see the highest incidence in young to middle-age adults, and looking at gender, it does appear to be a little bit more prevalent in women compared with men.
Wow, that is kind of scary. Do we have a reasonable idea about what causes PRESS to actually happen?
Once again, another great question. And as we're talking about PRESS, really there's two leading things about pathogenesis. And I know we don't like to do a deep dive, so we'll keep this at a very high level. Those two causes are first thought to be cerebrovascular dysregulation when patients come in with just an acute rise in blood pressure. And that's thought to be due to damage of the blood-brain barrier that allows vasogenic edema to enter into the white matter. And that's what we typically see on neuroimaging, and we'll get into that momentarily. The second etiology or cause, other than this cerebrovascular dysregulation, is cerebrovascular endothelial dysfunction. And that's typically associated with a whole host of things, such as exposure to medications. And the ones that are really keyed in on are immunosuppressed, say, transplant patients that are getting medications that may cause endothelial dysfunction, along with our cancer patients who are getting a variety of chemotherapeutic medications that, once again, can cause cerebral endothelial dysfunction. A few other things, autoimmune, other systemic disorders, even hematologic disorders, place our patients at risk for this cerebrovascular endothelial dysfunction and the possibility of developing PRESS. So those are the two primary causes or pathophysiology of what we currently think is behind PRESS.
All right, excellent. Now, you've kind of briefly mentioned and alluded to some of the clinical features. But let's do a deeper dive into the clinical features. How exactly do these patients present? What should we be looking for?
Absolutely. And it gets back to something we opened with in terms of the most prominent features or clinical features. By far and away, the most common clinical sign or symptom that we see is a nondescript encephalopathy. So patients may come in and they're going to be altered. That could range anywhere from just simple mild confusion all the way to decreased responsiveness or coma. And that's pretty much in everybody, mid to upper 90s in terms of the incidence of some encephalopathy. So that's the key clinical hallmark. Over half of the patients will have a diffuse, sort of generalized headache. And as we talk about other secondary causes of headache with that time-sensitive diagnosis or need to make the diagnosis, this typically the headache of press tends to be gradual onset. So not abrupt, not reaching maximal intensity within a very short period of time. It's usually a gradual onset of a generalized or diffuse headache. So we've got alterations in levels of consciousness, a diffuse or generalized headache. Other clinical features that are quite common actually are seizures. And this could be either partial or generalized. And about three quarters of patients with press at some point during their disease course will have either a partial or generalized seizure. And then the other big hallmark is visual disturbances. Close to one half of patients will have visual disturbances. And these can be subtle, simply diminished visual acuity. They could have visual field deficits. They could have neglect. And some even have cortical blindness. So those are the big hallmarks: encephalopathy, headache, seizures in most, along with visual disturbances. Much less frequency do we see focal neurologic findings, ataxia, hyporeflexia, and then the author quotes some spinal manifestations as symptoms. But I think those top four are the big things to remember.
Well, based on those symptoms, which are fairly nonspecific, it sounds like, to me at least, that we should probably be diagnosing press even more often. And it's no surprise that we've probably been missing this diagnosis, because the number of patients with headaches and altered mental status and then occasional seizures, those aren't rare presentations. But I'm not sure I've done the proper workup for these patients in the past. So that leads me to the next question. If we are suspecting this diagnosis, what kind of workup or imaging should we get? I'm assuming it's not just going to be a plain old head CT.
Exactly right, Amal. I think right before we go into neuroimaging and the evaluation, as we have so many new residents starting across the country and everywhere this time of year, I think thinking about a differential, and the authors do a great job in terms of what do we think about when we have, or what should we be thinking about when patients come in with the symptoms you just reviewed for us? Well, we'd be thinking about meningitis, a meningoencephalitis. Could be a vasculitis, or there's a number of vasculitides that may be the cause of that endothelial dysfunction and causing press. Toxic encephalopathies, along with cerebral venous thrombosis, could even be malignancy or even demyelinating diseases, are typically grouped in a differential diagnosis. Now, when we're thinking about this, I wholeheartedly agree with you in terms of we've probably been under-recognizing this condition. I think in most cases, thinking about that differential, we're going to start off with a non-contrast head CT. And for many patients with press, it will reveal edema in the bilateral cerebral regions, but it's not 100% sensitive. So really the test of choice when you're thinking about press is an MRI. And what the characteristic abnormalities on an MRI are include bilateral white matter regions, typically in the occipital lobes or the bilateral occipital lobes, and it'll demonstrate a vasogenic edema. Now, it could be in different areas. It's predominantly in the parieto-occipital location, but there certainly have been cases of press that have shown edema in the frontal region, in the thalamic region, cerebellar, and even brainstem and basal ganglia. But I think overall, the key location is edema in the parieto-occipital area on MRI.
Got it. Okay. Well, the key thing, of course, is that if you make the diagnosis, what difference does it really make if we've been missing the diagnosis? So that leads us then to management. How do we manage these patients? And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, if I've been missing this diagnosis and therefore not managing them properly, does it really make a difference? So take us through the management and tell us why the management does make a difference.
Absolutely. And there are a few key tenets of managing patients with press. No surprise, we want to control the precipitating cause. So getting back to those two primary causes from the pathophys standpoint and walking through that, is it a cancer patient on a chemotherapeutic medication? Is it an oncology or transplant patient on an immunosuppressant? Do they have autoimmune conditions or eclampsia or preeclampsia? Well, key tenet number one is really control or treat the underlying etiology. Following that, we're really going to aim at just a few things: treatment of blood pressure, managing seizures if they occur, and then in patients with a significant amount of cerebral edema, we're going to be managing them very similar to how we would manage other patients with cerebral edema and elevations in ICP. In general, patients with PRESS, they're presenting usually with markedly elevated blood pressures. They're going to require ICU care. About three quarters of patients go to the unit. And when we talk about blood pressure management, this is very akin to managing a hypertensive emergency. So rather than rely on non-invasive measurements, we really are going to lean more towards invasive arterial monitoring because we want to have a careful and controlled reduction in blood pressure. Now, there's no literature out there to say this is the exact MAP or systolic blood pressure we're going to target in PRESS. But just like we treat hypertensive emergencies, we're going to reduce, or at least the author recommends, the reduction of systolic blood pressure by no more than 25% in the first hour. I would edit that to focus on mean arterial blood pressure rather than systolic. But having said that, controlling blood pressure, usually with an intra-arterial invasive monitor, bringing it down by about 25% in the first hour, and then a cautious reduction over the next 1 to 2 days. Now, with respect to agents, there's no optimal blood pressure agent that's been identified for patients with PRESS. And just like any other hypertensive emergency, you're going to base that on what the primary organ dysfunction is. The author recommends clavitipine, nicardipine, even labetalol, and I think these are very reasonable antihypertensive choices. In fact, it's probably what we would use at University of Maryland, the medical center. But when we think about other etiologies, such as preeclampsia or eclampsia, we would lean more towards magnesium and IV labetalol. So blood pressure control, if they're seizing, we're going to treat it just as we would any other seizure disorder. So our benzodiazepines are first-line antiepileptic medications, and then any other long-acting antiepileptic medications that you prefer clinically to treat them with are acceptable. There's no change in the management of seizures. And then lastly, treatment of any of those triggers, getting back to the precipitating cause, medication-induced, autoimmune-induced, hematologic, we're going to focus on treating those underlying conditions.
Got it. Okay. So if we diagnose them and we manage them, next question, what's their prognosis? How do they end up coming through all of this if we do everything right?
Great question. I think you asked me that and I neglected to answer. But in general, if we have appropriate management, we make the diagnosis, we early institution of supportive care, good blood pressure reduction and treatment of the precipitating event, well, these patients actually have a fairly good outcome. And when we image these patients, let's just say weeks or a month or two after their presentation, almost three quarters have complete resolution of the neuroimaging abnormalities that we've seen either on CT or MRI. So in general, patients have a pretty good outcome when we recognize it and institute appropriate management. Where patients do poorly is when, in addition to vasogenic edema, there's already conversion to some type of intracerebral hemorrhage. And mortality statistics or morbidity and mortality statistics are very similar to those patients that have an ICH. But I think that the big picture is when we get treatment on board early, we have that safe, controlled reduction. In general, patients do fairly well with PRESS.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, that was a really great discussion, Mike. Are there any final take-home points that you want to leave the listeners with?
Yep. Just wrapping up exactly what we've talked about. Think about this in patients who are coming in with some degree of encephalopathy. They report headache. They may have presented with seizures, and they also have visual disturbances. Those are the top four clinical symptoms and signs that they present with. The most common abnormality on neuroimaging is going to be white matter vasogenic edema, primarily in the parieto-occipital lobes. If available, MRI is the preferred neuroimaging modality. And once you make the diagnosis, treat the underlying condition, safely control their blood pressure with an IV agent, no more than 25% in that first hour, manage seizures as you normally would. And something we didn't do a super deep dive into, if they have evidence of significant in elevations in intracerebral pressure, then we would manage them just as we would other folks that have conditions that elevate their ICP.
Excellent. Mike, thanks so much for taking us through this article and this topic. It is a really hot topic. And again, it's just surprising that Apparently, this has been out there for so long, but only in the past few years have I even been hearing about this. And the neurologists are all on board with this. And I think we as emergency physicians have to be on board with this as well. And your discussion in this article are definitely going to be a big help. So thanks again. And I really hope to get you back on EMCast in the very near future.
Thanks again, Amal. Always enjoy our conversations and really appreciate the opportunity to talk to all the listeners.
All right, folks. Well, next up, we're going to spend some time talking about alcohol use disorder. There was a really great paper that was published in the Journal of Emergency Medicine, actually an AAM position paper on the management of patients with alcohol use disorder. It is a white paper that was prepared specifically for AAM. The first author is someone that many of you probably know of, Dr. Ruben Strayer. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Rob Flint, actually brought this paper to my attention. I'm not sure how I missed it, but it's a really, really nice paper. And it's a long paper. It's about 100 pages. And so we're going to go through this. We're not going to go through every last detail, but the way the paper is organized is that the authors ask some very simple and practical questions and then provide some evidence to support their recommendations about how to manage these. And so we're going to go through a bunch of questions. And first of all, Rob, welcome back. And thanks so much for sharing this paper with us. I think it's really nice.
Thanks for having me back, Amal. I think this is going to be a nice conversation for our listeners.
Well, let's go ahead and jump in. Again, this is very, very practical and clinical. Question number one, when should alcohol withdrawal syndrome be suspected and how is AWS diagnosed?
So alcohol withdrawal is really unpredictable and can present in a variety of ways. Because it's unique to each individual, we have to have a high suspicion, particularly those that present with restlessness, agitation, anxiety. Other features are tremor, nausea, vomiting, tachycardia, and hypertension. Typically, symptoms start 2 to 3 days after the patient has had their last drink. Overall, patients with a hyperadrenergic state or presenting with a seizure should be suspected of alcohol withdrawal. If you can elicit a history of recent alcohol consumption followed by cessation, you'll clinch the diagnosis. There are several scales out there to use to quantify the severity of withdrawal symptoms, but you have to make the diagnosis first. These scales are only useful to prognosticate.
Excellent. All right. Well, which patients with AWS or at risk for AWS are appropriately managed as an outpatient and which require inpatient management?
So let's start with the easy ones. If the patient remains tachycardic, hypertensive, diaphoretic, or tremulous after you've done treatment in the ED, or if they have altered mental status or seizure, they need to be admitted. If they have a CWAS score over 19, or if they are pregnant, they also should receive inpatient care. Patients that tend to do poorly with outpatient treatment are those over age 65, those with a previous history of severe alcohol withdrawal, including seizure and or ICU admission, those that are concomitantly abusing benzodiazepines or barbiturates, those with high number of comorbid medical conditions, or if they have a history of longer or heavier alcohol consumption, and those that present to the ED having symptoms despite having a positive blood alcohol concentration, all of those really have a very poor prognosis if you try to manage them as an outpatient. So if a patient has good social support, limited medical comorbidities, and has no significant underlying mental health diagnosis or no previous severe alcohol withdrawal, and they can tolerate PO medications in the ED, they're likely to do very well as an outpatient. The obvious thing is you have to talk to family and friends and other supporting cast members and have really good discharge return precautions in place if you're going to discharge these patients.
Sounds very reasonable. Moving forward to question number three, in which patients should AWS be treated before the appearance of signs or symptoms? So essentially talking about prophylaxing against these.
Yeah, my thought is any patient you can't safely discharge before they start to show signs of withdrawal should be prophylaxed. So all of your ED boarders, unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of that. They should probably start prophylaxis if they have a history of alcohol withdrawal. And anybody who's going to be in the ED for a prolonged period of time for a medical workup or a mental health evaluation probably should also receive prophylaxis.
Sure. In terms of treating these patients with mild or moderate withdrawal symptoms, which medications should be used? What are they recommending?
Yeah, I think the first thing the article points out is the best way to time the medication is basically based on symptoms. So we don't work well on an ED based on we should do something every 4 to 6 hours. just time your dosing based on your symptom progression. And so they also talk about people presenting with mild withdrawal, which they define as anxiety, some insomnia, some diaphoresis, mild tremor, can actually be treated with carbamazepine or gabapentin. Rarely these are the patients we see in the ED, but it's really nice to have non-controlled substance options for withdrawal. If you look at moderate withdrawal, which they describe as headache, anxiety, tremor, some tachycardia, and a CWAS score from 0 to 18, they suggest benzodiazepines such as Librium or carbamazepine, valproic acid, or gabapentin. There's increasing literature that using non-GABAergic options such as valproic acid and gabapentin are equally effective to benzos and barbiturates. And as especially, we probably need to start looking at this and start using them more often. Speaking of phenobarbital, it really has made a comeback in the withdrawal literature recently. Advantages to phenobarbital over the benzos such as Librium include its longer half-life. Now, the article suggests it may be unsafe to discharge patients because of the long half-life, but there are several articles out now suggesting that there are very safe protocols to use phenobarbital. The ideal situation would be a single dose in the ED with outpatient follow-up the next day before that barbiturate gets out of your system.
Great. Well, that is some new information because we've gotten so accustomed over the years to benzos. I know back when I was in residency, we would use phenobarb oftentimes, and then things transition like 100% to benzos. And now phenobarb is making a comeback, as you say. But also, I really, until this article, hadn't heard about using carbamazepine or gabapentin or valproic acid. So there's some really nice new information for these mild and moderate patients. Now, moving forward, what about patients with severe alcohol withdrawal syndrome? Once you identify this, how should we be initiating management for these patients in the ED?
So let's define severe withdrawal as agitation, delirium, hallucinations, seizure, or really significant hypertension and tachycardia in the setting of alcohol withdrawal. Treatment is with intravenous benzodiazepines or barbiturates. My suggestion is you pick your favorite, stick with it, and be liberal with its administration. Honestly, these are some of the sickest patients in the ED. So you need to be at the bedside. You need to be pushing medicine every 5 to 10 minutes until you can calm down this adrenergic storm. The literature says that we really underdose rather than overdose these medications. So be liberal, use the medications until you get to effect. It's very unlikely you're going to overdose them. There's some limited data on using ketamine in these patients as well. And just as a reminder, if the patient ends up intubated, propofol is excellent for treating alcohol withdrawal.
Great. Ketamine shows up once again as the drug of choice for just about every condition in the emergency department. All right. Well, which medications to manage cravings should be offered to alcohol use disorder patients who are being discharged from the ED?
So what we're talking about is preventing people from having that urge to have the alcohol, that desire to not resume alcohol consumption. So there's really no evidence that benzodiazepines help with this at all. So medications such as naloxone, disulfiram, and gabapentin have been shown to limit alcohol craving, and there's some decent supporting evidence for that. These medications basically break up the reward cascade associated with alcohol ingestion.
All right, moving forward, what are the general management principles for patients that are presenting with presumed isolated alcohol intoxication?
So I think principle number one and kind of the overarching theme is don't assume they're just drunk. They can have alcohol concomitant with other medical issues and other trauma issues. So be vigilant in sorting out the intoxicated from the intoxicated plus. We know that alcohol use and alcohol abuse is highly associated with traumatic injuries as well as medical comorbidities. So just be a good ED practitioner, address abnormal vital signs, address mental status changes, and do a good head-to-toe physical.
Yep, I like how you started that out. Don't assume just drunk. I think I recall the great Jim Roberts had always talked about the fact that alcohol is one of those conditions that eventually fools everybody. We tend to overestimate and also underestimate alcohol. Now, moving forward, what is the role of the vitamins and fluids in the management of alcohol-intoxicated patient? We've all, I'm sure, grown up with that banana bag. The yellow IV fluids. Even I've had patients come in intoxicated who are upset because they're not getting the yellow IV fluids. So, what exactly is the role of these fluids and the multivitamins and everything else that we give?
So if a patient is simply intoxicated, we don't need an IV. IV fluid hasn't been shown to add any benefit to these patients. We can administer thiamine to the chronic alcohol abuser, either intramuscularly or orally. Really, IV insertion just prolongs ED stay. There's the risk of inserting the IV in an intoxicated patient. And there really has been no benefit shown to any of these long term for these patients.
All right, good. There's always been the myth that if you give IV fluids, it's going to kind of flush it out of their system a little bit faster, but we know that that's physiologically and pharmacologically, it doesn't work that way. How is agitation related to alcohol intoxication best managed in the emergency department?
So to be honest, I think this is one of the skills that really separates the experienced from the inexperienced ED provider. Often simple verbal de-escalation is effective in these patients, and you have to figure out which patients you can continue to de-escalate and which ones are going to need further intervention. Giving patients clear boundaries, but allowing them to maintain some autonomy is key. Often the threat of 10 people surrounding them only makes the issues worse. Have a conversation, give them their boundaries, and allow them to have some autonomy to preserve their dignity, and it often will give them a chance to relax and settle down. You obviously provide a safe environment, and if that doesn't work, then we've got to escalate to medication. So intramuscular medications really are the mainstay in these patients. You can quickly administer them. They have quick onset. The mainstay of the treatment is intramuscular antipsychotics with a benzodiazepine. Haldol with midazolam is a great option because midazolam has a rapid onset and is reliably absorbed. The antipsychotics such as Haldol, droperidol, olanzapine, they all have very similar properties, and using whatever your department has and what you feel comfortable with is very appropriate in this setting. Once again, ketamine comes back. Dissociative doses of ketamine can be excellent for the extremely agitated and combative patient. And then once you get the agitation under control, you should put them on a pulse ox to monitor them until they return to their normal mental state.
Good, fair enough. All right, let's say you've got a patient who is ready to be discharged. The next question is, what are the key considerations when discharging a patient who had presented with alcohol intoxication?
So I think to start with, you have to determine the level of intoxication and the environment you're sending them back into. So if someone shows up mildly or moderately intoxicated, those patients can be safely discharged into the care of a family member or a friend who's sober and responsible. They don't need to wait for complete clinical sobriety. For the more heavily intoxicated patient, you obviously need to wait for clinical sobriety. They have to be able to ambulate. They have to be able to tolerate PO. They have to be able to understand the discharge instructions. I think one myth that we have is there's a magic number for that. Personally, I don't draw alcohol levels on simply intoxicated patients. It's a clinical diagnosis, and it's clinically you follow them until they're sober. There's no magic number that says they're safe for discharge. And then obviously, if their social situation is more complex, such as they're homeless or other underlying issues, you really need to observe them longer until they are completely clinically sober and can be safe to go back out into that environment.
Great. We're going to skip over a couple of the questions that are not quite as clinically relevant or kind of have obvious answers, but moving forward all the way to number question 16 now in this paper. This is often a source of confusion, but what exactly is the role of the emergency department in reporting impairment in driving and performing forensic sampling?
Yeah, that's a great question. It comes up very often. So ASEP does have a policy that says reporting of potentially impaired drivers should be individualized to the patient's clinical condition and the clear risk posed to the patient and public by continued driving. Physicians exercising good faith clinical judgment should have protection from liability for the reported actions. So the bottom line is you have to know your state's laws. And I think if you're always doing what's right for the patient and what's right for society, in general, you're going to come out on the right side of the law and public opinion.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Well, that was a really great discussion. Again, this was a fairly extensive paper, and half the paper is references and a lot of additional supporting evidence behind some of the things that we've talked about. Rob, thanks so much for going through all this. Before you finish up, though, any final comments or points that you want to make, either from this article or based on your own couple of decades of practice in emergency medicine?
Yeah, I think I would just say these patients can be difficult. They're often not the most pleasant. They're often repeat visitors. They're going to try your patients and they tie up resources. But you have to remember these patients can actually be very ill and are very high-risk patient population. So spending that extra time to de-escalate, spending that extra time to get a history and physical will ultimately be good for you and for your patient. And just address the abnormal vital signs and the abnormal clinical findings. And again, the highest level of expertise, I think, is being able to deal with these patients in an effective, quiet manner.
Well, that's a great wrap-up. Dr. Rob Flint, thanks so much for taking us through this article. It's a really nicely written white paper for the American Academy of Emergency Medicine, and kudos to Ruben Strayer and his team for putting together a very clinically practical paper on a oftentimes challenging patient population that we really see all the time in the emergency department. Rob, I hope to get you back again on EMCast, and I will look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Amal.
All right, next up, we're going to spend some time talking about a very timely topic, and that is heat stroke and heat illness. Now, I recently discovered a really nice journal, the British Medical Journal Best Practices. It's primarily, I guess, online, and it's got a whole compendium of different review articles and guidelines and recommendations on different emergency medicine and other specialty entities. And one of the topics that I came across was a really nice article on a heat stroke. And it's fairly up to date. I don't know if there's a whole lot of new stuff, but it's definitely timely and worth talking about. This article was last updated in September of 2022. So whatever is new, I'm sure that we're going to be able to discuss. And of course, joining me to discuss this topic is one of my colleagues, Dr. Cheyenne Fallot. Cheyenne finished our residency and then did a chief year and faculty development fellowship. And now she's heading her career into more of an administrative line. She's our assistant medical director, and so she is staying on top of us when we're out of line, cracking the whip. But from an academic standpoint, she also has really developed an academic niche in wilderness and environmental emergencies, and so she's the perfect person to talk about this. She's lectured on this nationally before. Cheyenne, welcome back to the EMCast. It has been too long for sure.
It has, but it is always good to come back home.
And also, just to plug, Cheyenne is a guest editor on an upcoming issue of Emergency Medicine Clinics of North America that's going to be focused on environmental topics. We're looking forward to that. And as I mentioned, this is a very timely topic, and I kind of pestered Cheyenne a little bit about trying to get to this because all across the United States and across Europe, the weather has just been awful. It's been incredibly hot. I think a lot of people have really suffered. We've had a lot of patients coming in with heat-related illness. Just during my last shift, I had a guy who was doing some construction outside his building, and within about 15 minutes or so, he syncopized because he was wearing some constrictive clothing that didn't let him really ventilate air around his body too well. And so I thought, we've got to get to this podcast. And so, Cheyenne, thanks for joining. And so why don't we just go ahead and jump in? And the article starts out by talking about some terminology, which is great because I think there's a lot of confusion about various terms out there. For example, heat syncope and heat exhaustion and heat illness and heat stroke. And so can you clarify some of these terms with their actual definitions?
Absolutely. So, as is the case with a variety of different medical issues that we encounter in emergency medicine, heat illnesses occur on a spectrum of severity. Although there is some overlap between them, it is important that we use the correct terminology to minimize confusion. Heat stroke is the most severe form of heat illness and is defined by profound CNS dysfunction in the presence of hyperthermia, which is usually associated with core temperatures greater than 40 degrees Celsius. Heat exhaustion is what we consider a moderate form of heat illness. The core temperature will be less than 40 degrees Celsius, and there must be an absence of alteration in mental status or other significant CNS disturbances. And as we'll get into it later in the signs and symptoms, you can still have some mild CNS symptoms, but you cannot have an alteration in mental status as part of heat exhaustion. And although not referenced in this article, there are various other forms of what we consider mild heat illnesses that include miliaria rubra, otherwise known as heat rash or prickly heat, heat edema, heat cramps, heat syncope. But this article really focuses on heat stroke and heat exhaustion.
Got it. Thanks for clarifying that. How common of a problem is this? I mentioned this is a particularly bad year, but How common is this even outside of terrible summers like this?
Although we encounter many more common illnesses in emergency medicine, in the United States, heat waves actually cause more fatalities than any other extreme weather events. Wow. The reported incidence of heat stroke ranges anywhere from 17.6 to 26.5 cases per 100,000 in urban areas during heat waves, and it accounts for at least 240 deaths annually in the U.S. alone. Urban populations are actually particularly sensitive, owing to dense populations and infrastructure that tends to concentrate solar heat with poor heat dispersal. However, with climate change, this is actually leading to an increased risk of heat strokes anywhere, as those who are unprepared for heat waves are suddenly faced with their repercussions. And again, although not referenced in this article, there does also tend to be a significant amount of media attention paid to heat stroke, particularly in college athletics, with heat stroke responsible for quite a number of unfortunate deaths among NCAA athletes in the past 20 years alone.
Yeah, we definitely hear about those type of cases. And I don't think I've heard of any cases this summer, surprisingly. You know, maybe I've missed them, but I think fortunately, in many schools, especially colleges, word has gotten out and people are a bit more careful, but those things still do happen. Speaking of which, why is it that this happens to some people and not others?
So heat illness tends to occur when the body's thermal load overwhelms its thermoregulatory responses. High ambient environmental temperatures and humidity contribute to impaired heat dissipation, and if left untreated, heat exhaustion progresses to heat stroke. There are two main types of heat stroke, each with their own susceptible populations. Heat stroke can be classified either as classic or exertional. And classic heat stroke tends to occur in patients who have poor physiologic responses to heat under conditions of high heat stress. These populations include those who are sedentary or debilitated, elderly and children, people with cognitive impairment and chronic illnesses, those on medications such as diuretics or anticholinergics, those on illicit substances such as MDMA, and those who are volume depleted either acutely or chronically, or unable to increase their cardiac output. This classic type of heat stroke may develop actually over the course of several days. This is in contrast to exertional heat stroke, which oftentimes occurs in active, often younger people under conditions that produce heat stress through exertion alone, such as running a marathon, or in combination with a high environmental thermal load. And this includes both the temperatures and the humidity. This tends to be more common in cases of inappropriate heat acclimatization or in people with excess body weight. Exertional heat stroke develops rapidly within hours, and it is associated with slightly higher core temperatures than we tend to see in classic heat stroke.
Got it. Got it. I remember back when I was in residency, people made a very distinct, or at least prior to my residency, people used to make a very clear distinction between classic versus exertional. And then by the time I got to residency, people started saying that there really is some overlap. For example, people used to teach back in the early 90s, I guess, that classic heat stroke patients don't have sweating and exertional patients are always sweaty. And, you know, we know that's definitely not true. It can really be either way.
Yeah, those lines are a little muddied, but the good news is the final common pathway is the same, regardless of which it is. So although we use it to discuss it more eloquently, the treatment and how we approach it ends up being the same way.
Yeah. And you brought up certain populations that are at higher risk because of medications that they're on and also not having, you mentioned earlier, urban populations, and a lot of people just don't have air conditioning, which is really unfortunate in summers like this. Well, moving on to the signs and symptoms, what are the things that we should be looking for that would tip us off that a patient is experiencing some type of heat illness?
Until proven otherwise, you should assume a diagnosis of heat stroke in anyone presenting with any CNS dysfunction and an elevated core temperature. Although the definition of heat stroke involves a core temperature greater than 40 degrees Celsius, it can be present at lower temperatures in a variety of different settings. One is if the core temperature continues to rise even after the measurement and you've just caught it on the lower end of the upswing. cooling techniques may have already been deployed by the time you get to check a core temperature, or in cases of inaccurate core temperature measurement techniques. The CNS dysfunction that we mentioned can present as anything from confusion all the way up to coma, and that includes things like agitation, headache, anxiety, dizziness, ataxia, and nausea and vomiting. This tends to be because the cerebellum is particularly sensitive to heat injury. Heat exhaustion can still involve some of the more mild CNS symptoms, as I've alluded to previously, including dizziness, headache, thirst, weakness, and malaise, but there cannot be any alteration in mentation for a diagnosis of heat exhaustion. And these mild CNS symptoms that can be present generally resolve within about 2 hours. And when these patients undergo their intake, vital signs may reveal tachycardia and hypotension, the hypotension which can be due to either cutaneous vasodilation or volume depletion, and this may lead to cardiovascular collapse if not adequately resuscitated.
Got it. Okay, so when patients do present with an elevated temperature plus some type of mental status change, that's heat stroke until proven otherwise, but there are a handful of other things that we should keep in our differential also. Can you take us through those things?
Absolutely. So aside from what we're talking about being environmental hyperthermia, there are a variety of other conditions that may present with similar alterations in mentation, which the article references include delirium, meningitis, diabetic ketoacidosis, things like delirium tremens, or elevations in their core temperature. And this includes things like hyperthyroidism and thyroid storm, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, drug toxicity, serotonin syndrome. So there are a lot of things to consider in the differential diagnosis of an elevated temperature and someone who is altered.
Excellent. Now that we've made the diagnosis in this patient, what do we do in terms of the workup?
To start with, these patients need an accurate core temperature reading right off the get-go, which is typically obtained using either a rectal or an esophageal temperature probe. The further workup should then include a complete blood count with differential, a complete metabolic panel, and this includes both electrolytes and liver function tests, a coagulation profile, and a serum creatine kinase level, or CK level. In cases of heat stroke, all of these should be trended, the article references, at least daily for 2 to 3 days, as there can be a delayed onset of organ dysfunction. However, I'd like to offer my thoughts and say that these should be done with even more frequency than that, up to every 6 to 12 hours, as those patients who come in with heat stroke may progress to critical illness and progress pretty rapidly. A further expanded workup should be tailored to the clinical context. So it is possible that a patient may require a head CT scan if it's needed to exclude the possibility of a space-occupying intracranial lesion, like someone who's presenting with a lot of unexplained nausea and vomiting. An lumbar puncture, blood cultures, or chest x-ray may be required to exclude the possibility of an infection. In cases of suspected sepsis or shock, an arterial blood gas and lactic acid level should be monitored. In patients with a suspicion for endocrine emergencies, make sure that you get your thyroid function tests and that you trend blood glucose levels carefully. And in patients with suspected overdose or intoxication, a toxicology screen may be sent to look for things like cocaine, phencyclidines, or salicylates.
Okay, so once you're pretty sure about the diagnosis, how do we treat these patients?
So starting with heat exhaustion, it's generally managed by just removing the individual from ambient heat, augmenting their intrinsic heat dissipation methods by removing clothing and wetting the skin to assist with evaporative cooling, and then by providing adequate oral hydration to correct the mild volume depletion that generally presents with heat exhaustion. Although many of these patients can be discharged home, those with concurrent hyponatremia or significant volume depletion will require further medical workup and management. Heat stroke, on the other hand, requires much more aggressive management to rapidly decrease core temperature and provide necessary medical stabilization. The article reminds you to assess these patients using ATLS protocols and evaluate their ABCs. Cooling should be initiated in the field and continued upon transfer to a medical facility until the core temperature falls to about 37 to 38 degrees Celsius. External cooling methods are preferred, and they include immersion cooling using a cold or ice water bath, and evaporative cooling with forced air and mist. Internal cooling methods, such as gastric bladder and rectal cold water lavage, may also be used, although their setup tends to be much more time intensive and cumbersome than the external cooling methods, and I actually don't recommend this. Patients with heat stroke may be significantly volume depleted and may require infusions of normal saline up to 1 to 1.5 liters per hour to correct their hypotension and risk of cardiovascular collapse. Antipyretics, I just want to mention, on the other hand, have no role in the treatment of heat stroke.
This antipyretic issue, is there a harm in giving the antipyretics, or it just is not helpful?
It's absolutely not helpful whatsoever, because antipyretics work to alter the hypothalamic set point, whereas environmental hyperthermia is just that your body is overwhelmed with heat. And when your body is overwhelmed with heat and kind of progressing to critical illness, any additional medication that you give that isn't necessary can have its repercussions and muddy the picture. So if there is no role for it whatsoever, just don't give it.
Okay, that makes sense. And I know in your prior lectures, you've also talked about just how important it is to not just lower the temperature, but you've got to do it rapidly. Do you want to just touch on that?
Absolutely. So you have about 30 minutes from the recognition of heat stroke to employ the cooling methods and start to reach that target temperature of 37 to 38 degrees Celsius before permanent and irreversible damage starts to set into cells. And both the liver and the cerebellum do tend to be particularly sensitive to heat injury. So these methods have to be employed rapidly and effectively.
Yeah, and that's such an important point that I don't think gets emphasized often enough in most lectures or papers or textbook chapters, that this really is an emergency, that where time, I don't know what the proper term would be, time is liver or time is brain, I'm not sure, but time is life, how's that?
We tend to call it the golden half an hour. Like, there is the golden hour in trauma. I like to refer to this as the golden half hour in heat stroke.
I like that. All right, so you've really got to get that temp down very, very rapidly. You know, it's interesting, in this article, the authors mentioned dantrolene, which I haven't really heard much about in the past, or anything about in the past, for a heat stroke. What's the story with dantrolene?
So if you dig into your medical school days, or you have colleagues who are anesthesiologists, you may remember that dantrolene is a skeletal muscle relaxant that inhibits calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And it's used primarily in the treatment of malignant hyperthermia. There have been some small trials studying its use in heat stroke, with some recent renewed interest as an adjuvant heat stroke therapy, but there remains no evidence to date to support its use in the treatment of heat stroke. So as we said with antipyretics, if there's no evidence that it helps, don't do it. It will just muddy the picture at best.
Okay, great. I'm glad that you were definitive about that. That makes it easier. All right. When these patients come in, they're at risk for a lot of different complications. You kind of alluded to liver and cerebellar issues. Can you go over what the complications are that can occur to these patients?
Yes. So as you mentioned, patients with heat stroke are prone to developing a range of very serious complications. Their labs and physical exams should be closely monitored for the development of shock, which is due to the dehydration and vasodilation leading to cardiovascular collapse. Acute respiratory distress syndrome, which is in part due to the large volume fluid resuscitations that are oftentimes required for these patients. Patients can develop seizures due to primary heat insult or the concurrent hyponatremia that is oftentimes seen. Bowel ischemia can be due to gut hypoperfusion, rhabdomyolysis, and acute renal failure are common, and acute liver failure due to the direct heat insult or, again, hypoperfusion is oftentimes seen. And the liver failure can lead to coagulopathies, but also disseminated intravascular coagulation can be a complication of heat stroke. And again, once these serious complications set in, these patients require aggressive critical care.
Sure. I guess with the liver issues, that's all the more reason to stay away from acetaminophen.
Absolutely.
with the rhabdo and renal failure staying away from the NSAIDs. So again, that really highlights your point about not giving antipyretics to these patients. Okay, so we've started very aggressive cooling measures and we're doing everything we can. How do these patients generally tend to do down the road?
Just like heat illness being its own spectrum, the outcomes occur on a spectrum as well. Heat injury, even mild to moderate heat illness, releases an inflammatory cascade that may increase the risk of repeated heat illness over subsequent days. So patients should minimize heat exposure in the 24 to 48 hours that follows even mild to moderate heat illness. Patients with a history of heat stroke may also be more likely to experience repeated episodes of heat stroke. These patients may undergo heat tolerance testing to determine their repeated risk, and this is recommended especially for athletes who develop heat stroke. What this heat tolerance test involves is an evaluation of core temperature, heart rate, and the sweat rate while exposing an individual to exertion, usually a 3 mile per hour walk at a 2% incline, under heat-loaded conditions, which is usually 40 degrees Celsius and about 40% humidity.
Oh, that's really interesting. I had not heard of that heat tolerance testing, but it does seem like it makes sense, you know, definitely with all the concerns about athletes and all the money that's being poured into professional and collegiate athletes. I'm sure a lot of them undergo that type of testing if they've ever had heat stroke before. Well, let's talk a little bit about not only our patients, but also us. All of us, or most of us in emergency medicine, love outdoor activities. And given the current weather conditions across the US and Europe, all of us also are at risk of heat illness. So what preventive measures should we be taking for ourselves? And also, should we be recommending to our patients when they are outdoors doing different things?
Prevention is key. So vulnerable populations, but as you said, really all of us, should maintain adequate hydration, avoid excessive heat exposure, and if we must be exposed to heat, wear loose fitting and light clothing, and really monitor our exertion levels, knowing what the signs and symptoms of heat exhaustion and heat stroke are. Athletes should be advised to acclimate for at least 3 to 4 days before exercising in conditions of high heat and humidity. And yes, that does include all of us when we are out and about in nature or even in urban populations.
Great advice. Great advice. That was a really great and very timely review. Cheyenne, do you have any final pearls or take-home points for our listeners from your own prior research and lectures that you'd like to share?
Definitely. So recognition of heat illnesses and heat stroke is fundamental, but I cannot understate the importance of being prepared to logistically execute the treatments. If you do not already have departmental or institutional protocols in place for heat stroke management, let this serve as your inspiration to create them. Then make sure that all of your staff, and I mean everyone from faculty to advanced practice providers to residents and nurses and techs and transporters, everyone is aware of the time-sensitive nature to the interventions required in the recognition and treatment of heat stroke. Ensure that your nurses know that core temperatures are necessary. Know what resources you have available for immersion cooling. This will oftentimes be a body bag that you can fill with ice and water and will require multiple runners to bring you literally all of the ice that you have in your department and water. Know that heat stroke patients are at a high risk of multi-organ failure and be able to advocate appropriately for critical care admissions, even if the patient is teetering on that pseudo-stability. If these processes and knowledge are in place prior to that heat stroke patient arriving in your emergency department, then you will be able to care for them with greater ease. And that is important for such a time-sensitive diagnosis.
All right. Well, fantastic information, Cheyenne Fallot, our wilderness and environmental expert. Once again, great, great recommendations. Cheyenne, I hope it's not this long again before we get you back on the EMCast, but thanks so much for your time. And we will, I guess, talk again real soon.
My pleasure. Always nice talking with you, Amal.
Next, we are going to spend a little time talking about a really important topic that relates to care of elderly patients, for the most part, care of elderly patients in the emergency department, although this is definitely something that extends, unfortunately, to some younger patients as well. And that has to do with managing the patient who is a hospice patient in the emergency department. I know many of these patients, even though they're on hospice care, they oftentimes will show up in the emergency department, and that can oftentimes lead to challenges and somewhat controversy about how exactly to manage these patients. Well, joining me to address this topic is Dr. Danya Koja. Danya has been on the EMCast many, many times, and one of her particular areas of academic interest and her niche is geriatric emergency medicine. It's been a while since she's been on the EMCast because she's been moving around a bit. She used to be part of our faculty and kind of still is, certainly in our hearts, if not on paper. And her husband's in the military, so she's moved around a little bit. Now she is in hot, sweltering Tampa, Florida, working in a community hospital, but still very involved in academics with the national organizations. And so, first of all, Danya, welcome back. It's been too long.
Thank you for having me back. And I absolutely agree. It's been way, way too long.
And also, I'm sure, too hot. Everything I hear about the news lately has been about the terrible heat down south. And so hopefully you are in a very well air-conditioned place as we discuss this case.
That is correct.
Well, why don't we go ahead?
I try to not make our conversations about managing heat illnesses. Okay. So I avoid it.
Anyway, it's really nice to have you back. And as we know, your areas of interest are geriatrics and then second, neurology. And so we'll get to some neurology, hopefully, in the coming weeks and months. But this is a topic actually that you had suggested, hospice and emergency care. Now, these seem like two fairly mutually exclusive concepts in terms of what we've always thought of as emergency medicine. Why do you think it's important to talk about this?
So just like you mentioned before, Amal, hospice patients are seen in the ED a little more often than we think they would or should, right? In one study, 20% of patients on hospice had an ED visit, 15% were admitted to the hospital, and 5% were either admitted to the ICU or died in the hospital. And those are patients who are supposed to be on home hospice. So in our minds, we're like, well, why are these people in the hospital? And the reality is that home hospice patients usually present to the emergency department because they develop alarming symptoms. And their caregivers are either unable to manage these symptoms, or they're so emotionally distressed by these symptoms that they bring them to the hospital. And when I say home hospice, it doesn't necessarily mean the patient's own home. It could be at a skilled nursing facility, but outside of the hospital itself.
Got it. Well, what are some of the common pitfalls about caring for patients that are on hospice when they show up in the emergency department?
I think the biggest pitfall is that not understanding the difference between palliative care and hospice. Palliative care is like this big box. It's a broad category that includes hospice. And when somebody is on palliative care, they receive supportive treatment for their chronic and debilitating illness, let's say COPD, CHF, cancer, whatever it is, but they may seek curative therapies. But when they're in that hospice bubble or that hospice box, these patients receive comfort care. They do want supportive treatment for their chronic illnesses, but they are no longer seeking curative therapies. And understanding this difference allows us to tailor the care that we offer to patients. Another pitfall is thinking that everybody who is on hospice has a do not resuscitate order. That is actually not a necessary part of being on hospice. Some people may just never be ready to give up the idea of CPR, and they will write that in their medical record. They'll make sure that that is annotated in their desires. And others see that the DNR order is an assurance that they will die a natural death. And that's really important to them. And they really want to make sure that that's there in their charts. And for some people, they're never going to make a decision. And they leave that up to the often distraught or uninformed family members to decide in a crisis situation. Interestingly, some hospice facilities may require a DNR before admittance, but a few do not. And they advertise that quite heavily on their websites. Like, that's a huge pull that they do not require patients to have a DNR order. And that's why not everybody that shows up is DNR, and we got to check. We cannot make that assumption.
Well, let's jump into some of the presentations. What symptoms do hospice patients typically present with when they show up in the emergency department?
So the most common symptoms that come in with are pain, dyspnea, secretions, seizures, hematemesis, hemoptysis, and delirium.
Okay. Well, that's a good list. Why don't we start out by talking about some of the more common ones? Let's start with pain. What's your approach to patients when they show up with a primary presentation of pain?
I think the first couple of things we need to do are, one, to clarify the expectations with the patient and with their caregivers if they're around. It's important that we convey that it's very unlikely that the patient's pain is going to zero or no pain, but our goal is going to be improved comfort. And being on that page with everybody is going to be very helpful for us to actually reach that goal. And then the second most important thing we need to do is understand what the patient's home regimen is, because we need to figure out if they're opioid tolerant or opioid naive. Just because somebody takes some opioids at home does not mean that they're opioid tolerant. It has to be a specific amount of opioids per day that they take to make them tolerant to opioids. And that magical number is 60. So if they take more than 60 oral morphine equivalents or morphine milligram equivalents, they're the same thing, just different letters, then these patients are considered opioid tolerant. And the way we do that is that we look at all of the opioids that they take, immediate release ones, long acting ones, patches, and then we need to do some math. So if they're on morphine, like oral morphine, that's really easy. One oral morphine is one oral morphine. If they're on hydromorphone, each 1 milligram of oral hydromorphone is equivalent to 4 milligrams of PO morphine. So the typical dose that we hear patients on, which is 4 milligrams of hydromorphone, that's 15 milligrams of morphine. When we're looking at oxycodone, each 10 milligrams of that is equivalent to 15 milligrams of morphine. Fentanyl patches, they usually come in micrograms and they're like 100, 150 and so on. The 150 micrograms is equivalent to 15 milligrams of morphine. So as you can see, a lot of these are, hey, what is equal to that 15 milligram of morphine? And if the patient takes 4 of those or more, then that's it. You've hit your opioid tolerant status, which is the 60 or more.
That's definitely a lot of math. No differential equations involved here, but it does involve quite a bit of calculations.
It does. And I personally think that's why we end up not dosing these patients correctly. We just look at all these numbers. We're like, yeah, well, we're not going to do that. And then we just make up a number. We give the patient something and it doesn't work because we're underdosing them. There's actually a ton of resources online that can help us offload this task from our very busy brains. And a specific one that I find quite easy to use is something called the Opioid Calculator from the Oregon Pain Guidance Organization. But Google is fantastic. If you just Google that, you'll find it. And other resources like UpToDate and so on have these like morphine equivalency tables.
All right. I'm going to have to check whether Siri and Alexa can figure this out for me. All right. So once all of these calculations are done, then what?
So what we need to do is we need to look at their daily OMEs or how much they've taken over the past 24 hours and calculate 15% of that. Whatever that 15% is, we can give them that as morphine IV as long as, you know, their blood pressure tolerates it. Keep in mind that PO and IV are not the same thing. So for example, let's say somebody's taking OxyContin 60 milligrams BID and then takes oxycodone 15 milligrams every 4 hours as needed. And in the past day or two, because their pain is out of control, they've been doing it around the clock. So they've taken that 6 times. A little bit of math here, it's 210 OMEs. So 10% of that is 21 OMEs. So that's 7 milligrams of IV morphine. Now, I know this doesn't seem like a lot. Usually when we're talking about, oh, somebody's coming in with belly pain, we can give 6 and 8 of morphine quite easily. But reality is when your hospice patient comes in, who's grandma who weighs 45 kilos, I can bet you anything, no one is giving that 7 milligrams. People are starting with like 2, which I'm not sure what that does.
Is there an alternative method if we don't know what the patient's taking, or frankly, if we don't want to do the math?
So some experts talk about the concept of fentanyl titration, which can scare some individuals into doing some math. The idea is that you would bolus patients with fentanyl every 5 minutes until you get their pain under control. So you give them a bolus of 50 micrograms of fentanyl and reassess them in 5 minutes. If their pain is still over 4 out of 10, you give them another 50. And then in 5 minutes, you reassess them again. And then at that point, you give them either 75 or 100 micrograms. And then again at 5 minutes. So you're there by the patient's bedside for around 20 minutes, and you end up giving them somewhere between 250 and 300 micrograms. And I know that that sounds like a lot, like, hey, you just gave somebody 300 micrograms of fentanyl. But in all reality, if you're looking at the equivalency charts, that's equivalent to morphine, like 12 milligrams IV or like 2 milligrams of hydromorphone. We give that all the time. And it's pretty important to remember that if that's what you're doing, the phenyl titration, you need to have naloxone ready at the bedside.
Got it. Good point. Well, one of the challenges in frail patients at the end of life is establishing IV access. And, you know, gosh, it's awful. Sometimes these patients have arms that are bruised up and down, and they just don't have good IV access. Is there anything that we can do about that?
One option is to give them their home medications PO, but increase the dose by 50 or 100%. So almost double their home dose, and that can at least get them started while you're working on a more reliable IV access. So for example, instead of trying to blindly look for IV access, get somebody to put an ultrasound guided IV, or if that's within their wishes, to have a midline placed or a PICC line. Another option is to supplement it with intranasal fentanyl. So we can definitely do the whole fentanyl thing intranasally, but we just got to keep in mind, obviously, to keep the naloxone around for safety.
Got it. I like that. Any other tips on pain management?
So just a couple of thoughts is that when we're choosing some medicines, IV fentanyl tends to work faster and cause less hypotension than morphine or hydromorphone. So in our patients who are also like dehydrated, their blood pressure is borderline, that might be a better option. And then the other thing is that opioids are not our only option. Patients who have bone pain actually really benefit from the addition of NSAIDs. And patients who have neuropathic pain can really benefit from tricyclics such as gabapentin and venlafaxine. And then the other thing that also helps with pain is corticosteroids. So whether dexamethasone, prednisone, prednisolone, that's all stuff that we can also add to our opioids to help with the pain control. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of data on managing pain at the end of life with ketamine or acetaminophen, interestingly. So these two may not be what you would reach out for first.
All right. Well, that was a really good discussion of pain management. What about shortness of breath? That's definitely a common presentation as well. What do you do when you're approaching these patients?
You're absolutely right, Amal. This is quite common in patients with terminal cancer, for example. Around 70 to 80% of them experience dyspnea at some time during the last 6 weeks of life. And aggressive treatments such as intubation and non-invasive positive pressure ventilation may actually just increase their suffering and prolong the dying process, which puts us in a really tough spot because usually in our minds, if somebody's really that short of breath, that's what we go ahead and do.
So what about just administering oxygen then for comfort?
I don't understand what that means, to be honest. And now science backs me up as well, because just giving people oxygen like 4 to 5 liters by nasal cannula does not relieve cancer-related dyspnea. It just makes us feel better, like we did something.
Got it. So what do you do?
So what we can do is we can give opioids in really small doses, because that can decrease the chemoreceptor response to hypercapnia, anxiety, and the sensation of breathlessness. And I think the fear with that is that when somebody's short of breath and then you give them some morphine, that we're going to like kill the patient. But there's actually no evidence whatsoever that opioids trigger or quicken the dying process. Now, just to be clear, we're talking about very small doses, things like 1 to 2 milligrams of IV morphine or 0.2 to 0.4 milligrams of IV hydromorphone. So tiny, tiny doses. Those are the ones that can help with that sensation of breathlessness and make the patients feel better.
Sure. So you're not giving doses that are going to induce more respiratory depression. You're just trying to help the patient with the sensation sometimes of impending doom or that sensation, that awful sensation of not being able to breathe then.
Absolutely.
What about benzodiazepines, using a pure anxiolytic? What's your approach to those?
So a lot of people talk about that, but interestingly, they don't relieve the dyspnea itself, but they just relieve the anxiety that's associated with the dyspnea. And then when they were comparing them to opioids, they were more likely to be associated with drowsiness and respiratory depression, which is why opioids would be preferred in the situation. That said, if somebody's on a chronic benzos for anxiety, it may be appropriate to use in small doses in that person. Just keep in mind, if you're also going the opioid route, you can give them identical doses of what they take at home, because that might be a little too much.
What about, non-invasive ventilation?
So that's a really tricky question, because technically it can improve the difficulty of breathing, but it can actually be uncomfortable and it can prolong death. Like, it's not going to change the outcome of where they're going. It's just prolonging it, which is exactly the opposite of the concept of hospice, right? And that's one of those things where it needs to be a case-by-case basis, definitely for reversible causes more so than the actual dyspnea related to the disease itself. So for example, let's say somebody developed a pneumonia on top of their disease, and you're like, okay, well, maybe this is just going to help ease them through this time of pneumonia. And then there's something that we don't tend to see a lot in the emergency department, but are physically available elsewhere in the hospital, and we can always ask our respiratory therapists to bring that, is that there are much more comfortable masks than these massive things that we put on patients' faces. There are nasal masks that are a lot more comfortable, that allow patients to actually still talk, have access to their mouth, wet their lips, or do whatever it is that they want to do while they're on the BiPAP. So that is definitely something that we can talk to our respiratory therapists about and see if they can get that, if that's within the patient and their caregiver's wishes.
Any other thoughts about managing shortness of breath?
So some people have talked about distress protocol, and that's something to use in patients who have lung cancer or end-stage COPD with respiratory distress. And the idea is to give them enough medications to sedate them and decrease that dyspnea by giving them midazolam 5 milligrams, morphine 10 milligrams, and scopolamine 0.4 milligrams. All are subcutaneous, so it's not as dramatic as if it is IV, and that allows it that slower release. But it's a lot of meds, and the idea is that that way, in 15 minutes, they're sedated. They're not struggling with that breathlessness. And studies have shown that that did not hasten death.
Well, that's a great summary covering pain and shortness of breath. And some of those other presentations that you mentioned tend to be treated more normally as we do with other patients. And so I think this is a really great discussion to talk about probably the two most vexing and common presentations with these patients that are in hospice. Any final take-home points that you want to leave the listeners with?
I think the most important thing is to not make assumptions that if somebody's on hospice, they're DNR. We definitely need to sit down and understand what their goals of care are so that we can take care of them the way they want to be taken care of. When it comes to pain, the most important thing is to lay some ground rules or expectations that we're not going to get to that zero, and understand what they do at home so we can take it from there. Either calculate the OMEs, the oral morphine equivalents, and give them the 10% of that as morphine, or do that fentanyl titration of 50 micrograms every 5 minutes times 4 doses and have that naloxone at the bedside. And remember that opioids are not our only option. We can give them NSAIDs, tricyclics, steroids, depending on what's the cause of their pain specifically. As for shortness of breath, morphine is fantastic. 1 to 2 milligrams, again, tiny, tiny doses. And considering in certain patients on a case-by-case basis, giving them some non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. And if you're comfortable with the distress protocol of midazolam, morphine, and scopolamine, give it a try.
Fantastic. Danya, thanks so much for joining us once again this month. As I mentioned at the beginning, it's been too long since we've heard from you, and hope to get you back to discuss some more geriatric and neurology topics. Until then, please stay cool and take care.
Thank you. Thank you again for having me.
All right, folks, well, it is time for our wrap-up summary. And as you recall, we started out with the discussion of PRESS, also known as posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, also oftentimes referred to as reversible posterior leukoencephalopathy. Obviously, PRESS is a whole lot easier. This is an acute or subacute cerebral syndrome with the following clinical manifestations. Those can include headache, encephalopathy, seizure, and very, very commonly they have some type of visual disturbances. These tend to occur after an acute and severe elevation in blood pressure or a blood pressure elevation that's outside of the patient's normal range. The most common features clinically are some type of nondescript encephalopathy, which can range from mild confusion up to a decreased responsiveness and coma and seizures. The majority of patients will have a diffuse, gradual onset of a generalized headache. As I mentioned, they can have seizures, and visual disturbances are very, very common. How are you going to work these patients up? Well, you're probably going to start out with a CAT scan of the head, which is what we will start with most patients with altered mental status. And the CAT scan of the head is not diagnostic, but it will often reveal edema in the bilateral cerebral areas. And that, in conjunction with the elevated blood pressure and the symptoms, is probably enough to give you your diagnosis. But the diagnostic test of choice is going to be a cerebral MRI, in which case you're going to see bilateral white matter regions that demonstrate vasogenic edema. To manage these patients, you want to control the precipitating cause and get in control of that blood pressure. You want to drop the blood pressure, just like normal hypertensive emergencies, no more than 25% but you want to be aggressive enough to drop it that amount in the first hour or so. So you don't want to just sit on these patients indefinitely. You want to manage the seizures just the way you normally manage the seizures. And then obviously they're going to be admitted to the hospital. Probably 3/4 of them are going to end up in the intensive care unit. But fortunately, these patients tend to have a pretty good outcome. Next, we talked about that white paper involving alcohol use disorder from Journal of Emergency Medicine. The focus of the paper largely was on managing the withdrawal in these patients. These patients tend to have a hyperadrenergic state. They may present with a seizure. And when you're treating these patients, well, most people know how to take care of these patients. If you've been practicing emergency medicine for any length of time, you know how to take care of these patients. But I thought there were a few surprises in terms of management. In terms of the treatment, with mild withdrawal symptoms, for example, anxiety, insomnia, mild tremor, or diaphoresis, the first-line medications that they suggested considering were carbamazepine or gabapentin. And I'll tell you honestly, those are not medications that I've used before for this particular purpose, although I have to admit also that the majority of the patients that I'm taking care of don't have mild withdrawal symptoms. Once they get into that moderate range, which is probably when most of us are thinking about treating, you can still use the carbamazepine and the gabapentin. You can also consider valproic acid, but more frequently we're giving benzodiazepines, Librium, or chlorodiazepoxide epoxide for these patients. So you've got a handful of different choices. And then once you get into the range of severe alcohol withdrawal syndrome, those are the patients with agitation, delirium, seizures, significant hypertension and tachycardia, and so on. At that point, you're giving these patients larger doses of intravenous benzodiazepines and or barbiturates. And you oftentimes need to be fairly aggressive with the frequency of dosing and also the size of the dose. In addition, there is a few medications that you might consider offering to manage cravings in those patients that are being discharged. And amongst the medications that were brought up includes gabapentin, but also disulfiram and naloxone. And you need to really make sure that the patients know that, especially with that disulfiram, that if they do end up taking alcohol with the disulfiram, there can be some real major side effects associated with that. But those are medications that you might consider. Right. What's the role in reporting impairment in driving and also forensic sampling? That's going to need to be individualized based on the patient's clinical condition, and you probably ought to know about your local state laws in this regard. You want to do what's best for the patient and for society, and Dr. Flint brought up an important point in that physicians exercising good faith clinical judgment really should have protection from liability. Next, we move on to quick pearls from the discussion of heat illness. Remember, there's different levels of heat illness. So we've got heat stroke, which is the most severe end of the spectrum. This is defined by profound CNS dysfunction in the presence of hypothermia. We've got heat exhaustion. These patients tend to not have quite as high of a temperature, and these patients also have a fairly intact mental status. So the altered mental status really is the diagnostic feature separating heat stroke from all of the more mild type of conditions. Heat stroke oftentimes has been described as classic versus exertional, and I think that type of thing still probably shows up on the boards. The classic type of heat stroke is associated with patients who have a poor physiological response to heat under conditions of high heat stress. Most commonly, these are elderly, and they oftentimes will have some type of cognitive impairment. They can't kind of extricate themselves from the hot environment. They may have some other chronic illnesses, or they may be on medications that prevent appropriate heat loss, for example, anticholinergics. The exertional type of heat stroke is more frequently associated with gradual progression over the course of hours. These patients can have really, really high body temperatures. And probably the most common example of the exertional heat stroke is the marathon runners or the other people that are fitness enthusiasts who just kind of overdo it in the hot environments. I mentioned with heat exhaustion, these patients should have an intact mental status. They may have very mild CNS symptoms, for example, some dizziness or headaches or weakness or malaise, but they really should have an intact mental status. And these patients when treated aggressively, their symptoms tend to resolve fairly quickly over the course of a few hours. They may have tachycardia and may even be a bit hypotensive just from the dehydration, and they may have low-grade fevers as well. Management of heat exhaustion is largely just going to be supportive therapy, and the vast majority of these patients can end up being discharged home. With heat stroke, these pretty much always are going to be people admitted to the hospital, and you really want to move quickly with very aggressive cooling. There's different types of cooling that you can employ. There's external cooling methods. There are internal cooling methods that we talked about. And also remember that with these patients, the faster you lower that core body temperature, the better their outcome is going to be. You ought to be shooting for a significant reduction of that core body temperature within 30 minutes. So you need to really move quickly. Antipyretics really have no role in these patients. So focus on the cooling methods, not medical or medication type of methods for cooling. The last topic that we addressed was managing the hospice patient in the emergency department. And our discussant, Dr. Koja, brought up some pearls and pitfalls. Amongst the interesting pitfalls she brought up was, number one, that there's oftentimes a misunderstanding between palliative care versus hospice care. They're not the same thing. Palliative care patients receive care for their chronic and debilitating illness, but they still may seek curative therapy. However, hospice patients also seek supportive care, but not curative care at that point. And also, the other pitfall that she brought up was, don't assume that every hospice patient has to have a DNR order or do not resuscitate order. Some of them may still desire full resuscitation. So you need to look at their paperwork and address with them, or if they're not able, addressing with their next of kin what their desires are regarding the resuscitation. There's a couple of major presentations that Dr. Koja talked about. Number one, she talked about managing their pain. And again, it's very appropriate to be liberal about managing their pain with analgesics, addressing whether they need opiates, and also take a look at how much opiates they're on. And we're not going to go into that in this summary, but she talked about calculating the required doses of opiates for these patients based on what they're already on. And then she also talked about managing their dyspnea. And there's a myth out there that just putting patients on oxygen seems to improve cancer-related shortness of breath, but it really doesn't. So this is another time where opiates might be needed. Non-invasive ventilation may or may not help these patients. If you're going to use non-invasive ventilation, consider using just nasal bilevel positive airway pressure as opposed to the full mask, which can be very disconcerting and uncomfortable for the patient as well. So that's a handful of pearls and pitfalls in terms of the summary, but there really was a lot of great stuff that our four speakers talked about. I hope that you've been able to pick up a lot of pearls from this month. And I hope you're doing well, and I look forward to talking to all of you next month. Bye for now.
Hey, thanks for listening to MCAST. And for listening to the end, here's a discount code for you. Use discount code PODCAST for 10% off each year of an annual subscription to emedhome.com.